welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, those film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound mixers, sound designers, stunt coordinators, composers, VFX gurus, casting directors, you name it, and I'm talking to them. And as you all know, I love talking about film. This week is a fun episode of Behind the Lens, as I'm doing something that I haven't done before in all these years, and that is give you an interview with a film's director, followed by my interview with his cinematographer. That film is the thriller Baron's Cove. The director is Evan Ari Kelman. The cinematographer is Matthew Jensen. Some of you may have already heard or read my interview with Evan, as it's been up on the website behindthelensonline.net since October, before the film had distribution. But having just interviewed Matthew on Tuesday, and the film just came out in theaters and on VOD on Friday the 6th, this is the perfect opportunity to pair these interviews up for you. But you're going to hear those later in the show, because first, hilarity ensues, thanks to co-writers, co-directors David Joseph Craig and Brian Crano, as they talk about their new laugh-filled collaboration, I Don't Understand You. Based on their own life experiences, David and Brian give us the characters of Dom and Cole, a couple on the verge of adopting a baby, as they embark on an Italian vacation, the perfect opportunity to reconnect before the new edition arrives. Everything is picture perfect, the epitome of a European baby moon. But then things begin to spiral out of control. Lost in the woods on their way to dinner, their car gets stuck in a ditch, leaving them stranded in rural nowhere during a torrential downpour in Italy. These two Americans, who are used to being catered to, very much so, they are now in a foreign land with no cell service, zero comprehension of the Italian language, no Italian-English dictionary, and as fear takes over, escalating turmoil that could explode at any moment, and in fact does, and it involves bloodshed. Co-written and co-directed by Brian and David, I Don't Understand You stars Nick Kroll, Andrew Rannells, who was a grand marshal in yesterday's Pride Parade in Hollywood, Morgan Spector, Nunzia Sciano, Eleonora Romandini, Paolo Romano, and Amanda Seyfried. As you'll hear, Brian and David highlight the humor and language barriers that are a core of I Don't Understand You. They even recount a true incident where they got stuck in a ditch in rural Italy, which inspired the film's plot. You know, they always say write about what you know, and the truth is stranger than fiction. This film is the perfect example of that. The film was written during the pandemic, interestingly enough, emphasizing miscommunication and physical comedy. And it's interesting that Brian and David had to somewhat reverse engineer elements of the story once they found their location in Italy. They really wanted to go back to Italy and film this in Italy, and they made it happen. The key location, a farmhouse, was chosen for its suitability and the challenges within it that give rise to some incredible physical comedy, at which Nick and Andrew both excel. But of course, there isn't just humor. There's a bit of bloodshed and horror, which itself will have you splitting your sides with laughter. We also talk about working with cinematographer Lowell Meyer and how lucky they were to get the legendary editor, Nancy Richardson, who worked closely with them to capture the comedy and horror elements. And for those of you that may not recognize Nancy's name, she is the editor behind Selena, 13, Stand and Deliver, Love and Monsters, Fighting with My Family, Insurgent, Divergent, Warm Bodies, and so much more. So just with that alone, You know, she is the right person for this job. She knows comedy, she knows drama, and she knows horror. So, without any further ado, take a listen as I talk with Brian Crano and David Joseph Craig, co-writers, co-directors of the hilarious I Don't Understand You. Gentlemen, there are no words for the insanity and hilarity of I Don't Understand You. This,
hey, Debbie.
This was, I was just gobsmacked watching the antics and the hilarity, the language differentials. You picked up on all the tropes. When somebody doesn't understand you, what do? You talk louder, thinking that's going to make all the difference in the world.
That's what I do.
And Andrew did that so beautifully. But it's the one that both are so hapless in so many respects and so clueless. And all they know is they want to be a dad. All they know is they're going to Italy. All they know is they're going to celebrate with no thought to anything else. You are the this is the poster film for every company out there that puts out a print version of, you know, a dictionary. An English, Italian, yeah. English, German, German, English. You, this is it. This is the film that every manufacturer take your.
I want the royalties from that.
I'll tell ya. This is just so much fun on every level, and I know that this came about because of your own experiences. So I have to ask, short of the bloodshed. You know, unless you cut yourselves on a knife while you're eating. I don't know. Short of that, how much of this, of these antics are true? And how much did your fertile minds create?
I mean, the first act of the movie is pretty much true to our experience. We got stuck in a ditch on the night of our anniversary after having just matched with the birth mother of our now son. And we were there for like 5 hours in rural Italy in a downpour. And at some point during that time, we thought, oh, this will be a funny horror movie premise. And so, so we went with it.
Oh my God. What did you've got such a great cast of characters here. Not the least of which is Zia and her little underground restaurant. Hilarious. How challenging was it to write these setups for the language barriers that result, that kick things off for this one night in the life of Dom and Cole?
We, we're by nature both very silly boys and punny characters ourselves. And I think it came, you know, we wrote this during the pandemic. So we didn't know where the industry would be or if we'd even have one anymore once the pandemic was over. So we just kind of had fun with writing this and would just sink ourselves into deeper and deeper holes of miscommunication. And we would just read aloud to each other a lot. And it's kind of where they just kind of organically came up, while we were writing.
Now, something that I find really interesting, with you having said that, writing it during COVID, reading back and forth to each other, the location, that single residence, that single farmhouse is so key to the comedy here, to the physical comedy here. At what point did you know what kind of location you would have in order to script out and bring those comedic moments to life? Falling down the stairs is never going to be as funny if it's a 6-foot-wide staircase as opposed to a 2-foot-wide staircase or a room on top of a room or a low ceiling. At what point did you get an idea of the physicality of the spot, of the location?
I mean, we were really working backwards from the script. I mean, we wrote it during the pandemic and we stayed here. David and I went early for prep, mostly to get our son into like school and set up and living in Italy while we were working there. But it gave us a chance to scout the movie really early and get to know our crew through that process. So you know, we were able to find a location that had most of what we needed, but we also had to alter that location, remove an ancient staircase, add a kitchen into like what would have been another dining area. So we were able to find the things that we couldn't change, like the one staircase that you're talking about, and then make it all work for us. Otherwise, and it ended up being like such a wonderful location. I'm sort of sad we're still not there.
And I think to add to that, it's like we really wanted to shoot it on location specifically for the house. Mm-hmm. I think it would, like you're saying, if we would have staged this, we may have built something that was a little bit more convenient or easier to shoot on that might have not given you that same feel. And luckily, the house we found was almost ideal to exactly what we had envisioned in the script.
Oh, yeah, that house is absolutely perfect to tell this story because it gives you the comedic hijinks that you need, but also because of the construction, the interior construction, you get that horror vibe. So yeah. I just think it's an absolute ideal location that you guys found.
The interior is the interior of the exterior house. It's all the same location.
Wow. Now, how perfect did your cinematographer, did Lohmeyer, think this location was as you guys are blocking out shots, setting up lighting and things like that in this confined space?
Well, that's an interesting challenge. You know, we spend a lot of time in this dining room and trying, and we also spend a lot of the movie in a two-shot with Nick and Andrew. Mm-hmm. And so our big challenge is working with Lowell creatively. We're figuring out different ways to iterate on a two-shot to make it feel fresh and to see, you know, kind of create some ground rules for how those shots evolve through the movie. And also, you know, to what parts of this location, this dining room, are we seeing when we first come in? Are we seeing, you know, are we seeing these knives on the wall? Are we masking certain stuff and saving it for reveals? You know, so it was a fun puzzle to kind of work together to build.
That's because I was immediately thinking of poor Lowell and your camera operators looking at the interior of this house. It's like, where the heck are they going to put lighting? Where are they going to put a camera? Was Lowell shooting on sticks or was he going with a handheld or a shoulder rig?
It was a mixture. We had a lot of times it was he would put the camera on a sandbag and shoot off a box. Some of it's handheld and some of it is, you know, on a dolly.
It's kind of whichever corner we found. We had to make shift some of that.
How did the logistics within the house impact the physical comedy by Nick and Andrew? Because it looks like some of the shots are actually oners that are happening as they're weaving in and out of things. So I'm curious how that might have impacted their performances and capturing that on camera.
We looked at like movies like Clue and stuff like that, which have like a, you know, have that kind of, you're in one location and you're going room to room. And we tried to map certain things out in advance to give ourselves like a continuity of character and stuff. But also the other thing is like we were there for a number of weeks, both rehearsing and shooting the movie. So it gave everybody a long time to like figure out different bits we could do where and negotiate how it would all work and build up these different elements together. So it ended up being like a really nice.
We also only had two rooms in the house that we actually could set down track and follow. Follow a profile shot. So we knew that those were our rooms that we could actually track motion that wasn't going in front of or behind the character. And so we made sure to utilize that to our fullest extent.
And I have to commend Lowell, your camera operators, on capturing the facial expressiveness, particularly of Nick. You never sacrifice that. You don't lose it. And then you put all of this into the hands of Nancy Richardson as your editor.
Yep.
Talk to me about that. I mean, that just blew my mind. You got Nancy. How challenging was the edit on this one? Because you've got horror beats, you've got comedy beats, and the comedy is physical comedy, so you don't want to miss it. So how much of a challenge was the edit? Because here it comes down to your edit for the final product.
I mean, here it
it was actually not that much of a challenge, mostly because Nancy is such a ninja. You know, I mean, like we came into an assembly that was already like a watchable film, and it wasn't long. You know what I mean? And all of the character stuff was already built in. And what usually happens in movies, in my experience, is you spend about a month in the early part of the edit rearranging the order of scenes. And here, because the movie was over the course of one day, pretty much, and was linear, like, we didn't waste any time with that. So we could spend a huge amount of time just working on scene work, which is our favorite thing to do editorially, and, like, really digging into the performances and really making the stunt pieces work and so forth. So it was a real dream to cut this movie with someone who was such a talent, and we both learned so much from her.
Well, guys, job so well done. But now I want to know, where are we going for the next adventure, and this time with a toddler in tow?
Yeah, I mean, Denmark or Tokyo would be my dream, but we're working on it. We're working on it.
I hope so, because I want to see if the child comes across better and is more adept than his father's.
There might be two, Debbie.
Oh, guys, thank you so much. This has been so much fun, and I hope I get to chat with you again in the future.
Us too. That was so cool. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. And that was co-directors, co-writers, David Joseph Craig and Brian Crano, bringing you lots of laughter talking about I Don't Understand You. And trust me, they're entertaining and funny in the interview. The film is even funnier, because during the film, you don't have to listen to me. So there you go. I Don't Understand You is now in theaters right now. But now we're going to switch gears from laughter to the nail-biting tension of the thriller, Barron's Cove. Barron's Cove follows the story of a father with a violent past who is exquisitely played by Garrett Hedlund, as he grieves the sudden loss of his only child. Convinced of a cover-up and intent on obtaining answers about his son's death, he kidnaps the troubled boy he holds responsible. And he just happens to be the son of a prominent local politician. And this ignites a media firestorm and frenzied manhunt. But as he grows ever closer to finding... As Caleb grows ever closer to finding the truth, he is left to wonder whether his pursuers are really seeking to protect the boy or merely the secrets he keeps. Written and directed by Evan Ari Kelman, Barron's Cove stars Garrett Hedlund, Brittany Snow, a breakout performance by young Christian Convery, Hamish Linklater, Stephen Lang, and Raul Castillo. Now, talking with Evan Ari Kelman, it is clear that he has a deep-rooted passion for this project. And thanks to that passion, his thoughtfulness and attention to detail in bringing the story to life with believability and emotional resonance shines through on every level. And that's starting with Garrett Hedlund's outstanding performance as the grieving father, Caleb, a man who channels rage into forgiveness and empathy, setting the path for the film's emotional journey. Making Hedlund's performance so powerful is the chemistry and unfaltering dynamic he has with his young co-star, Christian Convery, who plays Ethan, the boy whom Caleb believes is responsible for his son's death. With a 22-day shoot, complex setups and scenes, many night shoots, and they shot night for night. And so you've got a kid, you're shooting night for night, then there's water work, stunts, fire, a lake. It was essential to have a collaborative relationship with his production team in making this film. And it's thanks to cinematographer Matthew Jensen that the visual grammar speaks volumes while showcasing the work of production designer Jordan Crockett, which provides the emotional foundation for the action of the actions of Hedlund's Caleb. Editor Hannah Park met the pacing challenges while letting us see and feel the emotional arcs and the growth of Caleb and Ethan. and still building and ratcheting up the requisite tension of this thriller. So, take a listen as writer-director Evan Ari Kelman breaks it all down for you with Baron's Cove. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
I'm very happy to be speaking with you today. How are you doing?
I'm so happy to be speaking with you. Really appreciate your time and your coverage of the film.
I got to tell you, Garrett Hedlund, and I have loved Garrett's work since the beginning. He kills it. He is astounding in this role, maintaining such a level of anger and rage. Yeah. Absolutely astounding. There aren't too many actors that could maintain that over the course of a 90-minute film.
Yeah, there's none. There's really none. And that's, you know, I mean, just to respond to that, I couldn't agree more. And thank you so much for saying that. Garrett gave everything that he had to this film. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to work with him so badly. And I feel, you know, so grateful that he was able to see himself in the role the same way that I envisioned him in the role. And he gave, you know, 200% to the movie in a way that I think translates on screen and makes this film what it is. I mean, you know, he's our main character. He's, mm-hmm. he's the person we're experiencing this through, and it lives or dies on his intensity, and I think he knocks it out of the park.
He absolutely does. But what I love here, what you've done in writing with the story structure and the script, Evan, is that his character of Caleb maintains this rage, but he starts to redirect it to someone else. As things yeah. develop, without giving away spoilers to people, because we don't want to destroy that big aha, oh my God moment for Caleb, he redirects and rechannels his rage over the death of his son. And that's what's really interesting, is to watch that emotional arc develop and how his perspective and empathy changes. And it was very unexpected, but it is so well thought out in story structure, in the dialogue, and in Garrett's performance. You cannot look away.
Thank you so much. I can't, you know, I cannot tell you how great it is to hear that. You know, not many people, just between us, not many people have seen the film yet. So that's like exactly the kind of reaction that I wanted to get. I've been working on this movie for 6 years. The single, you know, point of focus was hearing a reaction like that. So I can't thank you enough for expressing that. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, it's perfectly fine to make a movie that, you know, that goes all out on the anger and the rage, and there's value in that. But for me, the question is, how do we then transcend that? I mean, that's mm-hmm. what makes a movie so potent. It's breaking through to something on the other side, and that's why it took me years to write this, because I wanted to create a journey that, you know, if you were to just explain to someone, you'd say that impossible. And I don't want to spoil anything, but for me, what was so exciting was taking a character who was so angry, so rageful, and then transcending that to get to a place of sacrifice and forgiveness in circumstances that you couldn't imagine. And I think it's, you know, it's meant to be something like a blueprint for the audience's own abilities, you know, to forgive. This character can go through this, and if you can empathize with him all the way through and get that catharsis on the other side, it's going to change how people, you know, think about what they're angry about and who they're angry mm-hmm. with and the baggage they're taking into their relationships. And it's kind of, you know, that's why some people read the log line and they say, wow, this is really dark. It's not. This is an inspirational film. It was in my mind, and I think it sounds like it is for you as well. So I'm so happy that came through.
It is. It's very dark. It's an edge of your seat thriller. But when you get to the end of the film, and this is something that's so key, and that your cinematographer, Matthew Jensen, who is amazing, as always, that you use the tools in the cinematic toolbox to show us, to give us that inspiration at the end in terms of, number one, your location and the lensing of the water, the whole metaphor idea of baptismal, rebirth, the blue sky, the sun is shining brightly. Hope is there. It is the light at the end of the tunnel that Caleb has been going through.
Exactly.
I so love how you used your visual grammar to really show us the inspirational part of the film. Had you not done that, I don't know if it would be quite as effective. But you and Matthew really put together something wonderful with the visual grammar here as we go through this whole journey.
Thank you.
So I am curious about your work with Matthew and designing the visual grammar. You've got, number one, you've got some beautiful, beautiful shots happening here. You've got night shoots, obviously the location, you make it work with the wooded areas, the remoteness of it. The exteriors are beautiful. The night work, water, moon, lake, blue-black inkiness, negative space within the shed at the cabin at Barron's Cove, the basement, which is your set decoration, but it's so carefully lensed that we see the camera lingers on certain elements as the character of Ethan is looking around the room. So talk to me about how you and Matthew came up with this visual design, because it really is stunning.
You're honestly making me emotional, you know, noticing that, because when you are so deep in it with your cinematographer and your production designer, you are expressing something in through all the options that you can, through all the tools at your disposal, I should say. And that has to do with, like you said, the production design and the little details and the framing. But you never know if people are going to pick up on that or how it's going to translate. So to hear you recognize all of that effort is so gratifying, and I want to thank you for that. You know, how did we do it? It comes from a place of love. I mean, you take a script like this and you show it to a bunch of strangers, essentially. I didn't know Matthew, and I didn't know Jordan, our production designer. But once they read the script and they get it, it's like you've known them your entire life. You know, they believe in it, and then they're kind of your family in a way. Everything you do with them is an expression of love for the story, and it goes back to what we just spoke about, right? That transcendental arc, if that's the right word. All of us were inspired by that. So it's about how do we communicate that vision, you know, as fully as we can with the tools at our disposal and under the time constraints. Because believe me, we had all kinds of grand visions. And, you know, the reality is you don't get to do everything you want to do. So it's about what's going to be the most effective choice that is still feasible, and you hope that the audience gets it. So thank you so much for saying that. I don't know if that exactly speaks to that question, but thank you.
It does. You know, something that I particularly loved is that you and Matthew held back on your ECUs. Some people, yeah, in a thriller like this would go full bore with ECUs to try and convey emotion. You guys held back into mid two shots or even semi, you know, a mid close up shot so that we never lost sight of the surroundings, because that's so key in establishing Ethan's character as well as one of the driving forces of Caleb's rage. Is that we need to be in this world and to see all of these things that are impacting both of these characters. So I'm so glad at the framing choices that you and Matthew made here, because it keeps us in this world and you don't waste exposition with dialogue. We see it and see what the battling is, what the pain is about. And I appreciate that you did that, Evan.
Thank you so much. You know, every minute we weren't on set, Matthew and I were sitting in front of a huge whiteboard you know, with overhead views of the set, and we were drawing camera angles and putting together the whole plan. Okay, well, if we get this, do we still need this one? Can we come over here? What are we saying if we get this and we're a little bit wider here? How is this telling the story? And it's a whole, you know, it's an emotional equation to deliver exactly the result that you're speaking towards. The other place that that's coming from is a deep, deep appreciation for the production design.
Yeah.
Jordan Crockett, who was our production designer, and his team, they were so committed. They raised the bar for everyone else on set, including me, with their commitment. All of us were just living up to the example that they set in a lot of ways. And they worked so hard. I needed, out of respect for their effort and for their love and for their dedication and for the quality of what they were delivering, we had to see it. I needed to give that to the audience mm-hmm. as much of it as I possibly could, because it was a divine gift that they gave me and they gave the story, and I had to try to get as much of it as I could.
Well, Jordan is always, his work is always amazing. Look at any Marvel movie. He's amazing.
Yeah.
But he and his team with the set dress and the detail of what we see in that shed, the detail of what we see in that basement is just astounding. You left no stone unturned. Jordan and his team did an absolutely incredible job. And it also feeds into a theme that you have here. You know, we've got a multi-generational father-son story. We've got Caleb and his son, Baron. We've got Ethan, his father, the smarmy politician, Lyle. And then the smarmier, Lyle's father.
Exactly.
So what we see in Caleb's world, in Baron's world, it really, versus what we see in Lyle's world and Ethan's world, it really comes down to selfishness and ego versus selflessness in terms of thematics. Because here we have handmade stuff, kid stuff, things that you probably bought at Five Below, things you've collected outside in nature and brought inside, versus the shiny boat. Don't put that glass there. You're going to get rings on my exquisite table. So it's really interesting, the value system that you establish here that we see as being multi-generational coming down, which, absolutely. And that's what leads to selfishness.
Absolutely. You couldn't be more right. And again, you are really diving deep into the script, into the story, and it's so rewarding. It's so rewarding to hear somebody see that, because you never know if it's going to come across. So I just need to thank you again for drawing all of that, because that was so intentional. In many ways, it's a story about generational trauma and mm-hmm. the power that we have to either, you know, reflect it in a new direction or become, another unfortunate domino in that some broken metaphor, but I think you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Let me try that again. In a lot of ways, the story is about generational trauma and the power that we have over it, whether we're going to be the change or we're going to succumb to it. You know, you have Lyle, who has his own, you know, rageful father, and so he's rageful to his son, and that's one option. And then you have Caleb, who decides, you know, enough is enough. I don't have to be the next link in this chain. I can redirect this. In a lot of ways, for me, this is a story about, you know, the power of the narratives that we tell ourselves.
So much of the film also, in order to really get showcase your themes and to keep the audience engaged and to show us more than just Garrett as Caleb and his levels of rage in the film, so much of this falls on your editor, on Hannah Park. How challenging was the edit of this? Because you have the beats of rage, but then you also have to have the beats of fear and some heartfelt beats of, you know, at the funeral, at the memorial service. So how difficult was the editing process here to hit all of those emotional beats while building tension and finding a pace to keep people engaged?
Yeah, it's a really great question. You know, it certainly was a challenge, and the root of that challenge was, it all comes back to the amount of time that we had to shoot. You know, it was a very intense shoot. It was about 21 or 22 days. There was a lot to do. It's a very ambitious script with a lot of locations. And what that meant was some of our coverage, you know, wasn't, we could have done more. I would have liked to have done more in many cases because the actors were giving so much. I would have loved to have, you know, designed a specific shot for every single beat, but we just didn't have that ability because of time. So what that meant was you have a limited amount of shots per scene, and then it falls on Hannah to be, you know, the genius determining, okay, well, how are we going to actually use what we do have? And if we stay here a little bit longer and then cut to this moment, you know, does that mean we're saving this angle for something really special? And it's a whole other type of, you know, filmmaking that's done after the movie is shot. And I think she found the best possible way to really get the juice out of every single scene.
Yeah, I love the editing on this. I love the angles that Hannah chooses to use, especially in scenes between Caleb and Ethan. And this is also where Matthew's work comes into play in terms of touching the camera, eye level issues, because we see the power shifting. We see it start leveling out at one point between Caleb and Ethan as we become on eye level between the two of them. In a very, very key moment. So that shifts. Other than that, you know, Caleb, he's up. Here's a short little person. So you've got that whole power, the idea of power and strength over this child. So it's really interesting. And Hannah has done a great job with the shots that she selected and to cut and really tell this story visually as well as emotionally elicited through performances. Really well done job there.
Thank you. And it's so true. And what you're picking up on, it takes a very, very trained eye to notice that, because what you're describing is a lot of the work that we do and that, you know, that I did and Matthew did about, okay, what can we do subconsciously with the camera that's going to communicate, you know, the greater point and the greater emotion of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear that you picked up on that and you can see that work being done, it's so gratifying. And I think audiences, whether they actually recognize those choices consciously or not, it goes towards the emotion that they're feeling, even if they can't describe why. That's part of what's pulling them through the story and taking them on a journey. So I'm so happy that that's coming through.
Yeah, it really does. And I always appreciate that kind of attention to detail and that kind of use of the tools in the toolbox so that you're not wasting exposition. And people, they like visual aids. So it really does them good to see this. And as you said, it may be subconscious. They might gloss over it, but it impacts the whole emotional experience of the story and of watching the film.
And that's what cinema's for.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's all types of art out there and it all has their place, but that's something that cinema gives you that, you know, theater doesn't. And it's our responsibility as the filmmakers to use those tools that we uniquely have available to us to give audiences an experience that they can't get anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter how many tools we have, if we don't have terrific actors. You have a great cast here with Garrett. You've got Brittany Snow, Stephen Lang. Raul Castillo is wonderful as Detective Navarro. Hamish Linklater as Lyle, sleazy, smarmy Father Lyle. But Christian Convery, this could not have been easy casting Christian, because not only do you have to cast well with a child actor, and this adds another wrinkle into your production.
Indeed.
With timing and limited work hours and school and all of this, mandates to get thrown in there. But there's got to be that chemistry between Christian and Garrett, to a degree, and also Christian and Hamish, but very different chemistries between those pairings. So I'm really curious how difficult it was to find the right kid to play Ethan.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, we had extensive auditions, you know, looking at all types of, you know, child actors that could be a potential fit for this role. I did a lot of readings. And then, you know, I became aware of Christian, and I had seen a lot of his work, and I knew immediately that he had the emotional capacity to do this role. It's a complex role. It's extremely complex. There's a lot of different facets and a lot happening under the surface. And I knew he could do it, but even with that confidence, he surprised me with the depths of his abilities. You would be blown away just in speaking to him about the role. What he was able to excavate from this character and his backstory and his conflict and where he was going and what he wanted and his relationship with the people around him, I was amazed. I mean, my understanding of the character was deepened multiple times through conversation with him, and that's the ultimate dream of the director. When your actors understand the characters, you know, at levels you could only dream of, it just enriches the world. So for him to be able to do that with such a complex character in a very challenging film says a lot about his talent, which is so immense. I think everybody was just beyond impressed. Every day he was on set. And I could say the same for all of the actors. In a lot of ways, I got so lucky that the actors understood these characters from the script. And as a screenwriter, it's really rewarding. In many cases, I barely have to direct the actors because they understood from the writing exactly who they were and what they were trying to do, which was so gratifying. I remember in the diner scene, you know, there's a diner scene between Lyle and Benji, Hamish, mm-hmm. and Slang, and they came in with so much energy. They were their characters that day, and there was so much tension, I didn't need to touch it because it was electric. And I remember just watching the monitor, and like a tear went down my cheek as the writer who had sat at a table and struggled for years to bring these characters to life, to see them understand it so deeply and bring them to life was one of the greatest moments that I had on this film.
So now this is your first feature directorial, Evan. What was the learning curve like for you to go from doing TV commercials and some shorts to a full-blown feature, one that has this many elements packed into it, where you have child actors involved, you have a location that you've got wooded areas, you know, you have dangerous things that could be happening. Anytime you have water around, that's another element you have to worry about. So what was the learning curve like, and what did you learn about yourself as a director in making Barron's Cove that you can now take forward into future films?
That's a phenomenal question. It's something that I think about all the time. You know, I think as a filmmaker, it's sometimes good to be a little bit naive, because if you fully understood how difficult it would be, you might not even try to do it. this happened with a short film that I did as well. My NYU thesis film was titled Bandito. It was my first short to play at Tribeca. And it hinged on, you know, a semi-truck blowing up, which is not something that you would normally think of in a student film. And, you know, I said, oh, you know, we'll find a way. But because I was sort of naive enough to think that I could, we actually did find a way. You know, if I had spoken to an experienced producer, they would say, oh, you know, you could never do that. It's totally out of budget. It's completely unrealistic. But because I didn't have that sort of bias, I thought, yeah, I could definitely pull it off. And when you have that type of belief, often you find a way. And it was the same thing on this film. I had no idea. You know, it was like I had written the most difficult film to ever be produced. Like you said, you have a young actor, which comes with all kinds of restrictions on the amount of hours you can shoot per day, which is then, you know, multiplied when you start shooting at night. And we had a lot of scenes at night. It becomes even more restrictive. Plus, we were shooting on the water. Plus, we had you know, fire and stunts. And we had a limited, very limited schedule. It's like, are you a crazy person? Like, how could you write this as your first feature film? And yet, we pulled it off. And, you know, one of the things I learned is just the value of having a team like I had who are so dedicated to the story. You know, our department heads didn't see this as just another film. They believed in the message to the core, and you could see it every single day when they would, you know, be working late and they'd be finding new ideas and better ways. And what if we do this? What if we do that? It wasn't enough just to satisfy the requirements, but how do we deepen it? The value of that, I'm out of breath, honestly, talking about just how inspired I was.
I can tell.
Yeah. They've inspired me for the rest of my life, the people that I worked with. In terms of learning curve, you know, you don't know, you know, 22 days is a very abstract number, you know, when you, before you've done it, you think, oh yeah, 22 days, 24 days, you know, 18 days, what's the difference? But then you go through it and you realize the value of, you know, even if you had two extra hours or you had two less hours, you know, what that would mean. Or what is the difference between this budget and that budget? You know, before you go through it, you might not see much of a difference, and then you suddenly understand what it means. I think the other thing that I've taken away is, you know, how to work with a lot of different challenging elements, like you said, stunts, fire, water, night shoots. I feel like I could, you know, handle that in a way that I feel really capable now in a way that I couldn't have imagined before making this film.
Well, you definitely have demonstrated your skill as a storyteller and as a director, Evan, with this one. One thing I'm curious about, which so many directors, when they deal with children, especially in a film such as this, with some of the scenes that do get somewhat violent, there's fear, night impacts that and makes it even worse. Did you have concerns at any time with Christian and with the other kids about when to draw back or something might be too much for him to handle or require explanation or calming before or after a scene?
Thankfully, no. Everybody was so gung-ho the entire time that, you know, and everyone felt safe. I think that's really important to emphasize, that the entire time safety was paramount. We had, you know, a wonderful team of producers and a, you know, an AD department who made sure that everybody knew what we were doing at all times. Phenomenal, you know, stunt designers, that stunt coordinators that were, you know, making sure everyone knew exactly what we were doing at all times. There was a lot of conversation. There were no surprises. I think everyone felt very safe. You know, the only moment that's coming to mind for me with Christian where he said, you know, hey, hang on, it's just a second. He wouldn't have expected it, but there's a scene where he's eating a cheeseburger. Mm-hmm. And he said, Evan, I can only eat so many of these cheeseburgers, you know, while we're shooting. And I said, okay, we'll just do one more cheeseburger and that'll be it. You know, that's the closest that we got to making anyone feel potentially uncomfortable. And even in that case, it's not like he had ate, you know, multiple cheeseburgers. He was just telling me. I think this just speaks to the level of safety and comfort that we had on set.
If that is the most uncomfortable thing you ever have to worry about as a director and concern yourself with, is I can't eat any more cheeseburgers, it'll be smooth sailing for you from here on in, Evan.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Oh, my God. And I know a little bit about your dad, and I've read all your bios and stuff. I think this is a film that your dad would be so proud of.
Thank you.
You really...
Thank you. You know, yeah. He inspires me. He inspired me, continues to inspire me. He had a strong belief that, you know, we could achieve whatever we set our minds to if we, you know, worked hard enough and believed in ourselves enough. And I think that's inspired me to take the kinds of risks that I have, you know, to write this film, to try to make this film, to actually make this film. None of that would have been possible without the mindset that he inspired in me from a very young age. And so even though he's not physically here anymore, in so many ways he is, because that philosophy has made me who I am.
Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to see that your relationship with your father really is at the heart. It inspired this story.
It really did. It really did. And, you know, I got very lucky. Yeah, all things considering, yes, he passed away when I was relatively young. I was 11 years old. But in my mind, I consider myself, you know, one of the luckiest people in terms of, you know, the parents that I had. Not everybody was given that gift.
Yeah.
And so this story, I think, is meant to sort of speak to that a little bit. You know, that we have the power ourselves to kind of define our own identity and define who we want to be.
Well, you have done a good job defining yourself with this film, Evan.
Well, thank you.
I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you so much. I'm really grateful to hear that. And again, this is one of the first conversations I'm really having with someone who's watched the film and hadn't read the script and didn't go through the process. So you've made more than my day. You've made my week. I mean, if no one else watches the film, this is the reaction I ever get, it would have been worth it.
Well, I'm glad, Evan, but let me warn you, if it sucked, I would tell you that too.
Thank you. That means all the more. I really appreciate that.
You have done an amazing job with Barron's Cove. I can't wait for people to see it because it is so good, and it is such a great showpiece for Garrett, and everybody is going to really get to see Christian Convery. He's somebody to put on, that we all need to be watching out for.
I couldn't agree more. And thank you for saying that.
Evan, thank you so, so much. This has been wonderful. And I hope we get to chat again in the future.
I am so looking forward to it, Debbie. This was such a pleasure. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to kind of let some of this off my chest. I haven't been asked these questions before, and clearly there was a lot that needed to come out. So thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Evan. And you go have a wonderful weekend now.
Thank you. Thank you. You as well. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Evan. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
And that was writer-director Evan Ari Kelman talking about Barron's Cove. Now you get to take a listen as cinematographer Matthew Jensen talks about his collaboration with Evan and goes deeper into the lighting and lensing of the film and their importance as storytelling tools. Interesting is that many of you may know Matthew best for his work on tent poles like Wonder Woman 1984, the 2015 version of Fantastic Four, and even episodes of The Mandalorian. But Matthew began his career in the indie world. Now, with Barron's Cove, Matthew returns to independent filmmaking. And in our interview, he discusses the challenge of working with a smaller crew and limited resources. He highlights the importance of framing, avoiding extreme close-ups, using negative space. You'll also hear him talk about working with production designer Jordan Crockett and the strategic use of natural light and darkness to enhance the story's themes. It's an interesting interview, especially when you piggyback it with my interview with Evan. The respect each of them has for one another is just wonderful. This truly is a wonderful collaboration on a film. So, take a listen to cinematographer Matthew Jensen talking about Barron's Cove. Well, hello, Matthew.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
I am so happy to get to speak with you. I wanted to speak with you back in October when I first saw the film and I spoke with Evan. But you weren't being made available at that time. So the minute that this came back around with the distribution, and it's like, no, I talked to Evan. I don't need to talk to him again, but I want to talk to Matthew.
Oh, great.
So I am so tickled that I get to, because, number one, I'm a huge admirer of your work anyway.
Oh, thank you.
And I love the fact that you are one of those cinematographers, one of those artisans that you do these huge tent poles, or you do something as spectacular as Baby Yoda. but you still will come and step into a little independent gem like Barron's Cove. And this film is truly a gem. And so much of this film, of the story and what's being told, rises and falls on your lighting and lensing. The visual grammar that you and Evan designed, and I talked with him at length about this. You really, with the camera, with the blocking, with the way things are set up, tell so much of the story and the pertinent moments, the critical moments in defining characters, such as in the basement, and you have the camera lingering on certain items that Caleb has set up in the basement, items that were important to his son and important to him. And the camera sits on them and gives us a broader picture without words being said. Just so thoughtful, so stunning. I just love what you've done.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, you know, I started in independent film, and then, you know, through the years got involved with bigger movies, and doing this movie was a chance to kind of get back to my roots, and do something a lot simpler in terms of, you know, a production that mm-hmm. is not so logistically complicated and dependent on VFX and, you know, IP, for lack of a better word. This was really just a, you know, a good story, one that is morally ambiguous, you know, treads this very dark line and between revenge and empathy you know, to work with a new filmmaker like Evan. So, and it was a chance for me to just, you know, sit with characters and use the camera to, you know, use camera and sort of a film grammar to tell the story rather than relying on big setups and, you know, all the huge tools that you use on a bigger film. Mm-hmm. So, in that way, it was really intriguing and really a challenge because your crew is much smaller, the core is much smaller in terms of, you know, the amount of people who are making decisions. And so much more is riding on the shots. You don't have days and days to flesh out sequences, so you have to be incredibly deliberate with your setups, and every setup has to maximize the storytelling. So I'm glad that that was coming across in what you saw, because there wasn't a lot of fat on this movie mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, a lot of things that were cut out or anything. We shot what's in the movie, and that requires getting to the essence of what the film's about.
Mm-hmm. Something that I appreciate that you also did is with your framing. And you refrained from ECUs, which I found interesting, because so often in a film that has a thriller tone such as Barron's Cove has, cinematographers, directors, they want to go with a lot of ECUs. You didn't. You held mid shots and maybe just a semi mid that kept us grounded in the environment. We were never removed from this world. Nothing was disjointed. We weren't taken out by honing in on an extreme close-up of a baseball mitt, as an example. What you did with the framing and also the focal length of your shots really helped establish the world and the themes as they're shifting, the tone as it's shifting. And I just really took note of that and so appreciated that decision that you made. Just wonderful.
Oh, thank you. I think, you know, the idea behind that was dictated a little bit by the fact that we didn't have a lot of time. But, you know, the performances were all very physical.
Yeah.
And especially Garrett. So it was to give him room to move. And Everett and I talked about that the camera is not judgmental and that it's a little restrained. So it wasn't to sort of belabor the point, but and you know the film is very much about empathy, and so I think environment is key to that.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing your surroundings is I think something that provides context for the characters. So that was what was driving that.
Yeah, it really does in this particular film because there are so many moving parts behind Caleb. We get into Stephen Lang's character, and that's a whole separate thing. But we have to see the contextual nature of all of this. And we can't eliminate and just, you know, zoom in on one item. And it really helps communicate the vision of this story, of this film. So I am a big fan of what you did here. Something else you did in terms of your framing and also your camera angles. I love the eyeline matchups that you have that convey the shifting power dynamics between characters, especially when we have Caleb and Ethan. In situations, Garrett and Hamish, or Garrett and Christian, rather. I love the eye line that you achieve. You match this up. So, you know, and we go from, you know, young Ethan's eye line, we get Caleb's eye line, and then we see the shift in them until they're almost on a level playing field at one point in that third act. Stunning. Mm-hmm. Stunning storytelling through the camera.
No, thank you. Yeah, well, you know that they are very much equals in terms of you know their characters.
Yeah.
In that Christian's character is able to meet Garrett's character with the same kind of ferocity. He's not scared of him. And in a way they're kind of, you know, sort of shadows of one another. So, but I think that where Garrett's character finally succeeds is in really understanding Christian's character and, saying like, look, this is a path you don't want to go down because I know it.
Mm-hmm.
And, offers him some wisdom instead of brutality, which is all that Christian's character has been offered in his life so far. So, it was very much to, you know, put them, to make, even though they're, you know, Christian's a kid, but essentially to put him on the same level as Garrett's character.
Yeah. No, I absolutely love that you did that, and that is so key. By the time we get to that third act, and you've been working up to this. You know, as you watch the film, you're building to this until they are really on a level playing field. But it's done. We get to see it through your angles and the eyeline matchups that you develop. Just fantastic, because it really enhances the emotional journey of each of them. And the themes that Evan is exploring in this film. Another big element of yours that comes into play, negative space. I love negative space. And but I love it when it's used appropriately, judiciously, accordingly. And I love the shed and the basement. There's really quite a bit of negative space there. And then with the night shoots, we get negative space. But you complement that with the blue-black inkiness that we get from the water, the moon, the forest. Just fantastic. So I'm really curious about how you approached these night shoots and making the most of the negative space, be it externally, outdoors, as well as inside in that shed in particular.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, blackness is very much blackness. Darkness is very much part of the story.
Yeah.
You know, and sort of this creeping force around particularly Caleb and Christian as well, Christian's character. And then so there's sort of an aesthetic reason to do that. But I really wanted to explore on this movie because it's a certain size and I don't have the opportunity to light everything up. And I thought that one was unnecessary from a story standpoint, but also I just didn't have the crew or the time or the money to really do that kind of thing. So I thought I would embrace my limitations and really only light the necessary elements, and use black as a color, as a tool in the paintbrush.
Mm-hmm.
So in the palette, really. So, you know, that was kind of the basic idea. And it's fun. It allows me to do the kinds of lighting that I love and, you know, is very influenced by Gordon Willis and Conrad Hall and Roger Deakins and, mm-hmm. you know, the guys that I've admired over the years were, blackness is a character.
Mm-hmm. The result is just stunning. Now, I'm curious, you know, I know this was a short shoot. It's 22 days. Actually, it's a little long for me.
Wow, was it that short?
Actually, for many indie films, you know, 22 days is a big thing. Well, according to Evan, it was 22 days. But in here, what you're also shooting, you've got a lot of action happening with Garrett. You've got stunts. You've got fire. You've got water. You've got night. When you sit down with Evan, when you get this script and you see the story and how it unfolds, at what point do you start taking all of these elements, these extraneous elements beyond the words on the page, at what point do you start sitting down with him and starting that blocking, starting those ideas for the visuals, be it storyboarding, be it shot listing, to incorporate the extra steps that have to be taken with these elements?
Yeah, well, we started, we didn't have a ton of prep on this movie, and we were looking for locations the entire time, and, there were a couple of key locations that we had trouble finding, and so, you know, it was a scramble, but we sat down pretty close to the beginning of prep, and the two of us sat in a room with the script and a whiteboard and just drew everything out, floor plans and where we thought the characters were going to move. And then based our shot list around that. And we went into every day with a definitive idea of what we were going to do. And, you know, that would change
mm-hmm.
based on the elements that were, that we were fighting against, whatever it was, that would come up that day. And luckily we had a very responsive production team. I was able to bring my camera operator and my key grip, of many years to the shoot, and they had a lot of experience, and were very helpful in helping us manage, all of the elements that we were trying to tackle. But, we were up against it every day. There were so many things that, the irony is that the script was much bigger than the final movie. I mean, there were helicopters and, you know, longer chases and things like that. And, you know, as we got into the shoot, we realized, you know, we couldn't pull certain things off. And frankly, we didn't need to, given really when you get down to the essence of what the story is, some of the bigger action elements were unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
So we got it down to its essence.
How closely did you work with the production designer, with Jordan Crockett? Because there's great visual distinction happening here in terms of value systems and perspectives between Caleb and, of course, Ethan's father, Lyle. We've got Caleb, it's very handmade, natural, organic. Lyle is sleek, materialistic. Working with Jordan, what Jordan was designing, did that impact your approach in lighting and lensing certain aspects of the film?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, Jordan's fantastic and very creative and incredibly resourceful because he had so little to work with. And so it was imperative that the two of us were on the same page at all times. We spent a lot of time together in prep, and, you know, when we were looking at locations, he was looking at it from a design standpoint, and I was looking at it from a lighting standpoint, and we would, you know, work together. If he couldn't dress a certain location or I couldn't light it, we both said, then this is not going to work. But we were both dead set on bringing scale and trying to make this movie look bigger than it actually was. So we were also pushing to get the best looks imaginable in the places that we were going. So we were talking all the time. He would put up these great collages in the art department of all the references of furniture and, you know, wall color and everything like that. And my big thing on this movie was to have the walls darker so the faces would pop and so I could light through windows and, you know, very naturally and that kind of thing. And Jordan, you know, was all about it. And he was able to provide, you know, practical lamps on the set for me. And I was able to say, hey, can we have a light there? And that would help me out. And, you know, it'll add a warm glow to this scene. And, you know, it'll reflect nicely off your dark wood walls. And so we spoke the same language. The whole
1 minute left. All right. Well, then I have to ask you about, without giving away any big spoilers for people, but the visual metaphor, by the time we get to the end, to the third act, and all of a sudden we get a shift of, we've got the water, blue skies are suddenly there. There's sunlight appearing really for the first time. Very metaphoric for rebirth, hope, all of that great thematic stuff that gives us a good payoff for Caleb and for Ethan in this film. Did the movie gods and Mother Nature align for you to give you those blue skies and sunlight? Or did we have to manufacture that?
No, this was not a movie where you could do a lot of manufacturing. We were lucky.
Wow.
It wasn't entirely not by design, but, you know, we lucked out in a couple of cases.
So, in other words, the weather reports were actually correct for once.
Yeah, we tried to roll with the weather. We tried to roll with the weather.
And one last question for you, Matthew. You know, what is the most gratifying aspect of working on Barron's Cove and bringing it to life through light and lens?
What was gratifying for me was to completely shift gears and mm-hmm. to work with a new director and to work with great actors and do something in a very limited scope and create something cohesive. You know, I think that I've worked on big films, you know, the lessons you learn on big films inform the lessons and the choices that you make on smaller films. So it's always an education going, you know, in either direction. And I'm very happy that, I got a chance to do something like this that, is about people and about, ideas, rather than, you know, action sequences.
Well, I have to say, as I said at the top, I love your work on your big tent poles. And I am in love with your work on little indies like Baron's Cove. So I hope I see more of these indie gems from you in the future, Matthew.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
Oh, Matthew, thank you so, so much. This has been so wonderful getting to speak with you. And believe me, it was well worth the wait to finally get to do it.
Well, thanks, Debbie. I appreciate your interest, and thanks for having me on the show.
And hopefully we'll get to chat again in the future.
I hope so.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
And that was cinematographer Matthew Jensen. Baron's Cove is now in theaters and on VOD. Excellent production values, strong performances, most notably by Garrett Hedlund and young Christian Convery. A solid script with powerful themes. I encourage you to check it out. So that is all the time we have today. I think we're over again. As we should be. I'll be back next week with filmmakers Greg Porper and John Shimke, who are talking about their laugh-out-loud, hilarious new film, Don't Tell Larry. It is a riot. In the meantime, check out BehindTheLensOnline.net for more exclusive interviews, including quite a few FYC Emmy Artisan interviews. So until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.